Hi there.
I was asked to give a sort of an introductory thing to my philosophy. So that's why I'm essentially I'm making this audio clip. As an introduction, I guess you could say these are my opinions, but I try and stay as close to fact as I possibly can. As far as I know that the evidence implies, which I guess I'll get into in a minute. And I didn't prepare a script or anything like that for this. I just wanted to be as authentic with this as possible. That's another thing. I wanted to just speak from the heart. I didn't want it to sound canned, you know what I mean? I wanted it to be like as if I was sitting here having a conversation with you know? So I'm gonna split this up into two bits. The first thing I'm gonna talk about is like my philosophy on like I guess science and the supernatural, and the second thing I'm gonna talk about is like my political and social philosophy. More my social than my political. So let's start with the supernatural. Okay, so I am an ardent materialist. I do not believe that basically what I believe is that I want to rely on what science and evidence can show to be true, you know? And so far we have not seen any hard indicative evidence that there is a supernatural, and in fact, we've seen significant evidence that the supernatural doesn't exist at all. So, when I say that I don't believe in the, well, so I really, when I say I believe something, I'm talking more about like something that I estimate to be true, or that I'm guessing is most likely the truth, or is approximately the truth, but that I don't know it to be true because I can't show it to be true. And really, I'm more or less repeating an atheist activist who I really like named Aaron Ra. I would agree with him on his on most of his philosophy. I want to go where the science leads me to. You know, if I was trying to find a fact about something, like say for example, if I wanted to see, if I wanted to learn about how to read people, the first thing I would go to is like studies and academic papers or and books about the subject and things like that. I would not probably be thinking, hey, I need to go and learn like to harness my psychic abilities, for example, or something like that, because I don't believe that, like I haven't been shown that that's a thing that really materially exists, you know, in any meaningful way. And you know, so my view on the world is very material. I believe the same things I think that people who believe in the supernatural believe, except I don't add the supernatural element to it. I believe so what is a person to me? I think that a person is entirely physical mass. Like, you know, your brain is just a series of chemical processes that, you know, are just like they predictably can lead you to certain conclusions, and I say predictably. I also kind of want to add to this that I do not believe that I don't believe that free will exists. I do think that people in society should be treated as if they have free will, but if you really want to get to the nitty-gritty and really want to boil it down, people do not have free will. It's not like random chance that people make certain decisions. And the reason that I say that, there's a lot of reasons that we can show, like if you damage or alter somebody's brain, that, you know, like if you cut out pieces of the brain, that you can change people's personalities in predictive ways. And so that's not only evidence against the soul, but I think it's also evidence against, like, this concept, this sort of mystical concept that some people have of free will, that really, if you can change your personality and your brain in predictive ways, then, you know, the brain is predictive, that is something that like, has a, you know, you can, or let me put it another way. You know, economists, I'm sure, are very adept at this, or people who are adept in statistics know that people are predictable. You can go and ask an economics professor, or, you know, somebody who's in marketing or whatever, you can ask them, hey, could you predict, you know, how the market would react to this or this or this or this or this? And they would say yes. And the reason for that is because people tend to buy that product. So it's a predictable thing. You know what I mean? It's predictable, for example, maybe that older people would be more inclined to send things by snail mail than younger people. Like, that's something that you can, that is a predictable pattern in those demographics. You know what I mean? So, it's not really, I wouldn't say there's anything supernatural, for example, about saying, oh, well, you know, I go and tell someone who's like 70 or 80, hey, so you sent that by mail. And he's like, well, how did you know? Well, it's because I'm psychic. Well, no. The reason that you would be able to assume that is because they're a significantly older person and therefore are more likely to use snail mail than someone who's like, you know, I don't know, like 15 or 20, you know? I don't think that I know a whole lot of people who are my age or younger who would ever use snail mail unless it was for taxes or something. Like, it's not something that we do as part of, you know, I'm not even joking when I say this. And this is a little bit of a tangent, but I actually didn't know how to, like, where the address label should go on a letter when I was like 15. I actually more or less recently learned that because I had no real reason to use snail mail when I was younger, you know, or I had very little reason to. People have even less reason to now than they did when I was a kid, but still, you know, the point still stands that that's something you could predict about me just because of my age, and that's it, you know, because again, you know, by looking at, like, well, this is the society they grew up in, this is something we can tell about their age. Like, I don't know, you could even predict about somebody, like, oh, if you're older, then that means maybe you're more nostalgic, you're more likely to reminisce on the past than someone who's younger would in a similar vein. You're more likely to hold sentiments like, oh, well, the past was better than the present if you're, like, in the age bracket between 60 and 80 than you would if you were, like, I don't know, like 10 to 30, for example. You know, and that's not supernatural that you would be able to figure that. You know what I mean? That's just like, I was about to say common sense, but that's not a very good way to argue things. That is a pattern that is predictable in the population, you know, based on certain physical, factors at play, you know, the brain reacts to its environment in predictive ways, and it is absolutely not supernatural. And again, that's one of many justifications I could give for that. But basically, that's my so some people will assume that there's something supernatural about the human brain, or that, you know, that we. I guess by extension, a lot of people, and I understand why people want to believe this, because it really does genuinely feel like we have free will, but really we don't. Like, the things that you can, that you do are chemical patterns. The things that you believe are based on physics, not your, like, there's no absolute choice there. So, So that's my beliefs on free will. I actually went over a couple of things. So my beliefs on free will is that it does not exist. I would love to have that discussion with somebody. I don't believe that we as people have free will. I don't believe we have a soul. So that's a very commonly held belief about the supernatural, is that we have a soul, or that there's some like disembodied. So the assumption about the soul that I always hear is that you can, you know, there's a part of your brain that leaves your body when you die, for example. And, you know, different religions have different explanations about how that works. Like, does it reincarnate? Does it, you know, does it go into limbo? Does it go to hell or heaven? You know, things like that. But, you know, I go back again to the argument about the fact that you can alter your brain to, in predictive ways, can change your personality. So how would it then be possible for there to be a soul at play if, you know, you could, because, I mean, if you would, what you would expect if there was some disembodied element to your consciousness, you would expect that altering your brain would do absolutely nothing at all, that your thoughts would stay the same regardless. It would be sort of like, I mean, think of it like this, like when you connect to the internet, it doesn't matter what device you're on, you go to Google and it's the same website every time. You know, it loads the same way, it has the same content, you know, but that's because it's sending a signal to your device. And in a similar fashion, you know, a soul, we would expect a soul would be something that sends signals to your body and your body reacts accordingly. But that's not what we see. We see something very different from that. We see something more like what your thoughts are exist completely in your body, and can't leave your body. So when you so that, I guess I should go into what happens when what I think happens when I die. I have to go with the naturalistic explanation, which is that when you die, it just ends. It's just like when before you were born. You know, before you were born, it's the same thing, you know. You don't remember things from before you were born in the same fashion that you will not ever think about things when you die. So, essentially, life itself, it's some people have described it as blackness, but it's not even that, because in order to have blackness, you have to perceive black, but you can't even perceive when you're dead, you know. So it's really not something that it's hard to even describe it, because it's just nothingness. It's just lack of the perception that you've always had. Like, I can't tell you about my memories from the 1950s because I literally didn't exist in the 1950s, in the sense I wasn't conscious. I had no perception whatsoever, whatever. I was not a physical being at that time. In the same vein as when I die, I am not going to have these physical perceptions then either. So it's going to be the same thing, like exactly the same thing. Now, I think that idea is very scary to a lot of people. And so I think that a lot of people want there to be some kind of afterlife to go to. And I actually sympathize with that. I completely understand wanting that sort of thing. In fact, I would even say that I wish that we lived in a world where we could live forever. That would be something, I mentioned R and Ra before, but that would be something I disagree with him about. That's another thing, is there's no bias here. Like, if I was just believing what I wanted to believe, then I would believe in the afterlife, because I actually do wish that you could genuinely live forever in some form or fashion. But I have to admit that there's just no evidence for that, you know? Like, I'm sorry. it's unfortunate, and it is a nice fantasy to have, but it's just not real, you know? It's like how, you know, a lot of people, like, wouldn't it be so cool if you were a Jedi, or if you were in the Harry Potter universe, or whatever it is you like, but you have to, at the end of the day, admit that Harry Potter isn't real, Star Wars isn't real, in the same way that I admit that the afterlife isn't real, you know? So, these things, by the way, when it comes to things like the soul and the supernatural and stuff like that, those are also predictive in the sense, or those ideas are also predictable in the sense that if you look back historically, you can see the reasons why those ideas formed, you know? And it has been more or less the consensus for most of history, and I'll even concede that perhaps there is a natural reason why human beings assume spirituality, because it seems pretty consistent that humanity broadly, like every single society, seems to have independently come up with some kind of idea of religion or spirituality just completely independently of each other. And they have different interpretations of what that means, but the consensus has seemed to be throughout history that spirituality exists, that, you know, ideas like the afterlife or, you know, some inherent purpose or things like that have been assumed by human beings for as long as we can, like as far back as we can go. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's true, because there's still no truth to those claims. I would postulate, and I don't have like definitive scientific proof or whatever for this, but I would estimate that it is possible, and I will grant that it's possible, that religion is a natural, that at this point maybe it's an adaptation, for example, like a psychological adaptation, like maybe we just at this point we've been spiritual for so many tens of thousands at least of years, if not hundreds of thousands of years, that the brain just at this point probably assumes spirituality just because that's an adaptation that we've probably at this point, you know, like that we have. But I'm not adept in the science. I don't actually know that, but I'm just logically deducing that that's a possibility. And I will grant that that's a possibility, because a lot of people will want to say, like, religion is natural, like, on the religious side. I would actually tend to agree more than disagree with them about that. Or I would at least be willing to grant that postulation. Because I do believe that you go back and look at history, it does seem to bear itself out that humans do have this tendency to come up with spiritual ideas, or assume a supernatural explanation. That seems to be pretty consistent. I wouldn't even say pretty. Like, it seems like universally consistent throughout humanity that we've done this. So, I will grant that may be an adaptation. However, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. Just because we have possibly adapted to believe a certain way is not evidence that that thing exists. Because just in the same way that if I believe that there's a teapot flying in space, that doesn't mean that's true either. You know, it's just that I believe that. And maybe I believe that for reasons that you can possibly, if I do believe something like that, you can go back and look at the reasons why I believe that, and you can understand why I do, but it doesn't mean that it's true. So I'm giving you an explanation, like, hey, maybe it was some kind of coping mechanism, like we wanted to know the purpose behind our existence. We wanted to know that, but we didn't have the sufficient evidence for it, and we didn't for hundreds of thousands of years, so we just assumed that, you know, oh, well, it must just, let's just put a variable here, just make it up, you know? And then there's also the hierarchical thing, where somebody at the top wants to tell everybody, like, below them, like, hey, you know, this is the way it works, and so, you know, listen to what I say. So there could be that, too. But again, there's nothing there that says that a soul or spirits or any of that actually exists. It just is stuff that people said for reasons that you can explain without there being a supernatural. Like, you can look at the historical reasons that people have said that. It's for power. It's because they wanted an explanation, but didn't have one, so they just inserted one. You know, it's because they wanted to find comfort in the ideas like death and pain and suffering and misery. Because, I mean, you can't look at the world and be like, well, this is justified. So it's hard to do that. And so, you know, I think it's sort of comforting to have this idea like, hey, there's a purpose in all of that. It's not just that the world is cruel. It's that, you know, there's a reason why it's cruel and it leads to something good, you know? When in reality, unfortunately, the universe is a lot less sympathetic to us than that, I think. But it is comforting. It is comforting to have this idea that there's some hidden purpose behind all of this, you know? And I understand that. I understand why someone would come to a conclusion like that. It's just that I don't think it's true, you know, because there's a very significant difference between me understanding why someone would believe the things that they do and me agreeing with them. You know what I mean? Because agreeing with them would imply that I have a factual, like, that I believe that what they say is factually correct, which I don't. Not that I'm trying to insult them in any way, I'm just saying I don't think that they're correct on what they say. Now, I will also say that I am not a science geek whatsoever. I'm not even a math person. So here's where my strong suits lie. I'm a tech person, you know, I'm a software developer by career and by hobby and all that. And I'm very interested in, like, history, particularly, like, the history when it comes to the early 20th century and late 19th century. I feel like, because I do spend an awful lot of time reading books from around that time. So, you might say that I'm interested in, like, bibliographic science research and society broadly, and, like, historical aspects of society as well. And, you know, I'll give you an example when it comes to evidential thinking, because let's say that you hear from somebody, you know, that, like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an example. You could say that, actually, I've done this before, where I have, like, read a news article. Well, actually, I'll tell the whole story. So, there was a news article that I once read about, that was claiming that D.W. Griffith, the creator of The Birth of a Nation, which is a very racist, explicitly racist film, from 1915, the director of that film, the claim in that news article was, well, he's not racist, he was just following the clout. And he was an excellent film... It was trying to make the argument, I think, well, he was an excellent film director, and he was just following the clout, and we should just forgive him for making that racist movie, I guess. You know? I can never find the news article that made this claim to this day. I wish I could, but I really did read this article when I was, like, 15 or so. I found this news article, and I was like, really? You know? And so I went and did the research myself, okay? So, if D.W. Griffith, the director of The Birth of a Nation, really wasn't racist and was just following the clout when he made that movie, which, by the way, the movie was based on an earlier play with the same plot, but still, he adapted the movie. So the news article said he adapted the movie for non-racist reasons, okay? Now, I can tell you, I can give you the evidence right now as to why that's bunk. So the evidence is... First of all, that the movie is so, like, it's 3 hours long. The movie is a 3 hour, like, well, is essentially a 3 hour epic, and by epic I mean long, film about, like the, that is giving a, an ex, that is, the, pu, like, pinning to the ground a very explicitly white supremacist message. You know, if D.W. Griffith was just quote-unquote following the clout, he would not have, he, I guess if you want to say he was following the clout, you would be saying he's indifferent to the racist aspects of it. So I guess he wouldn't care if it ended up taking off, which it did. It was literally the most, one of the most popular movies ever made. But the thing about that movie is not only the film itself, like, if you go and watch the film itself, it becomes very clear it wasn't just something that was lazily put together. Like, he put a lot of effort into making it something very presentable that, that would, like, literally, like, kind of trap the audience into that ideology. Not just that, okay? But there was absolutely no apology whatsoever after that. D.W. Griffith, in later releases of that same film, said, you know, something along the lines of, like, hey, I know you guys are trying to censor me. I am not afraid of that. I will keep trying to present this movie anyway, despite the censorship, essentially. It was essentially the message that was put at the beginning of the movie in later releases of it. And then we have the movie Intolerance, okay, which was sort of a sequel to The Birth of a Nation, but what Intolerance did was it, what Intolerance was about was it was about supposed, like, historical incidences of actual, like, intolerance, like the movie is named. It's I wouldn't call it intolerance. I would call it, like, bigotry or oppression or things like that. But he was trying to give examples of this. So the movie by itself, when you watch the movie, it doesn't look like it's racist at all. Like, it doesn't seem like there's any racial element to it whatsoever. But the reason that he'd made that movie is because he made it as a response to critics of The Birth of a Nation, like, basically accusing them of being the actually intolerant ones. You know what I mean? And he said this in interviews that you can go and look up. So there was that. That's another piece of evidence in my favor that, yes, he really was racist. He wasn't just indifferent. He explicitly wanted to promote racism. And then, you know, in a subsequent interview, because he had an interview in, like, 1931, so that would have been, like, 15 years after the fact, right? You would think if he had changed at all or had been indifferent to the racism, maybe he would be a lot more apologetic to that idea, or the fact that that film got so popular or whatever, that he would give some semblance of an apology or something, you know? But he did not in that interview. Instead, he continued to promote the same ideas and, you know, whatever. So there's all these pieces of evidence that you can look up and you can see, hey, it definitely was not true that he was not racist. He was not just racist, like, just, like, indifferently racist. He was explicitly trying to promote racism in his work, that he very specifically wanted to drill it down, basically, that, you know, white supremacy is the correct ideology to have, or that white people should be afraid of whatever, you know, all that stuff. So I just gave you something that I am very well versed in. I'm not very well versed in biology, for example, but I am well versed, I think, in film history. And if someone makes a claim like, oh, D.W. Griffith wasn't racist, I can go and substantiate with solid evidence that he was, you know, pretty confidently. I can pretty confidently do that as someone who's interested in film history and, you know, such like that. So that's an example of where evidence can disprove a claim. And so you make a positive assertion and I could disprove it, right? With that evidence. Or, you know, you could also say that, you know, you could also analyze a person further by saying, like, well, there was evidence that he did have beliefs that weren't bigoted. I would agree with a statement like that, because there was Broken Blossoms, which was a film that basically highlighted, you know, like, the, you know, discrimination against Asian Americans and such like that, which is very strange coming from someone who just made a film about, like, where he essentially was saying that black people are the devil. You know, it's very strange coming from the same guy that he would also recognize the very real struggle of Chinese Americans at that time. It's very strange coming from him. But still, he did seem to have that, like, it is, I will grant that it is very possible that he had selective bigotry, that he was, so there is evidence that he was selectively bigoted, not necessarily that his white supremacist ideology was all-encompassing, like it would be for some people. But, so I would say that there's evidence for that. Some evidence for that. I wouldn't say that the evidence for that is, like, overwhelming or anything. I would just say that there's some evidence for it. But you can make a clip. So I just went off on a huge tangent. I'm sorry. This is a topic that I'm actually very passionate about, so that's why I was. But basically what I'm trying to get at is, once I have the evidence for that, then I can make the claim. So I have the evidence that he was selectively bigoted, and I can give the evidence that he was, and I can give you something to work with. I can give you something. Like, I could say, okay, here's a claim that he was selectively bigoted, and I believe this because I've seen this evidence for it, and here's what I can show you to show that I'm making that assertion or postulation, or at least hypothesis. I mean, even to have a hypothesis like that, you have to have some kind of evidence. With the supernatural, we have never had evidence of any kind for that. Nothing. We have never had anything. We've never gotten to a point where it was like, hey, you know, we have this positive assertion. Like, think of it like this. If we did, we would have faith healers working in hospitals. We would have prophets working as politicians. You know, where it's like, oh, well, or prophets working as therapists or whatever. We wouldn't have regular therapists. We would have psychics instead. Because why would you need a regular therapist if you can just have someone who can literally read your mind and know your future and stuff, you know? That there would never be a need for doctors. Because if I mean, and that's the thing. Is yes, I know that the claim is that with the supernatural, it's like, it's supernatural, so science can't explain it. But we would have to admit that there's a there, that there's something to discuss. Like, for example, if we had faith healers working in hospitals, you know what I mean? And we could have videos of faith healers doing what they do or whatever, then we have something to show. Even if science, as of right now, couldn't explain it, you know, there would still be science there. Just because, like, you know, you can at least prove scientifically that they did something. You know what I mean? Like, the doctors can go and look at the thing that the faith healer just did and be like, oh yeah, that's the way that, like, you know, that bone that was just broken, that definitely just healed just now. You know what I mean? Like, you can x-ray it and so forth. So there would be scientific evidence for that. Even if we couldn't explain how it happened, we could still explain that it happened at all. And we can explain how we know it happened, you know? But we never have that. We never have anything remotely like that. It's always just, you know, people saying stuff that, you know, is vague or whatever, or it's hard to prove. Like, oh, well, you know, because, I mean, I think the best arguments for the supernatural that I've heard were an absence of an explanation. Like, oh, well, you know, this thing happened to me and I couldn't explain it. So how could it have been anything but supernatural? And that's usually the best argument that that people like that can give, because you don't have anything to work with. So it's not. So when you make a claim like, oh, well, if you have these magic powers, you can heal people, you don't have any evidence for that. Anything. The best you have are just speculation, you know, honestly. Or you have some story, like if you have somebody who's like, you know, hey, I healed this guy who had a broken leg, and all of a sudden after I healed him, he got better. Or whatnot. Maybe it's not usually the person who does it who makes that claim. It's usually somebody who's like, hey, I saw this guy on TV who there was a guy in a wheelchair and he used his magic spell or whatever, and he got up and started walking. Well, if you were to look into that story, well, oftentimes what happens is there's huge gaps in that story. Like, you don't know why, you don't know if it was acting, you don't know if it was like staged, you don't know if it was, you know, whatever. Or maybe they give some semblance of like, hey, this is why it wasn't staged, but there's usually huge gaps between that. And it's not very easy to prove or disprove. Well, if I can't dis well, let me put it to you another way. If I can't disprove what you say, or if I don't even have a way to disprove what you say, then you don't have a way to prove it either, you know, because one of the things that I know about science is that everything has to be both testable and falsifiable. So I'll give you an example, because I do believe that history is a science. So if I were to make a claim like, you know, D.W. Griffith was selectively bigoted, but maybe progressive in some ways. If I were to make a statement like that, there is a way to falsify what I say. You can go and actually look at the movie Broken Blossoms, which I mentioned earlier, and you can point to me where you can actually we can actually have a discussion. You can point to me the lines in the movie or whatever, and you can show me how it wasn't progressive at all. You know, you could show me that it actually was a racist film, and you know, then I would be wrong. So that would be the way to falsify that claim, right? What do you have with someone who is a faith healer? How do you falsify that? How can I prove it wrong if it is? You know? And usually with these stories, I don't have anything. Like, I can't falsify it either because I don't have all the details that are necessary. Okay, let me go back to it. If you have a movie, Broken Blossoms, you have the details. You can go and watch the movie, you can look at the movie's transcript, whatsoever, whatever, you know, and you can analyze the movie in depth. And you also have access to all these film magazines and stuff like that that were released around the time the film was made to get a contemporary view on the film or whatever. You can go and search all of that. And you have all the evidence in abundance that you can look at and research. But with a faith healer, you have none of that. The best you have is some claim that some con man somewhere made. And that's it. It's just like, well, I saw on TV this guy do this, and I'm not even saying you're lying when you say stuff like that. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, you might actually believe that. I'm not saying like you're trying to pull something on me. I'm just saying I don't think you have all the details either, because I can also attribute that to cognitive bias. So when someone makes a claim like that, like, oh, I saw on TV somebody made a handicapped guy walk, then, you know, people who watch those things usually want to believe that those things are true. You know, that's part of the reason why it works so well. You know what I mean? Because if you want to believe something, then it becomes like you have a bias already. So your brain is going to start looking for reasons why you think that's true. So you're actually going to probably start overlooking other aspects that might show you that it's not true. You know, it's the same thing what people say about like the honeymoon period in relationships, where it's like you don't have you like your partner, you're attracted to them, so you don't immediately see some of the negative aspects that might be there. And then you see it later, but with TV and with things like faith healers, it's the same thing. Your brain doesn't want to accept, or because it doesn't want to accept that they could be wrong, you're not being skeptical at all, so you're just going and just, you're only remembering the things they got right, maybe, or the things that looked like they got right, and not the things that they got wrong. You know what I mean? So, I actually didn't realize that I would be going on for so long about that, to be honest. I'm already at 40 minutes, shit. But yeah, to summarize, I feel like I've been rambling on. I hope that any of this was meaningful. Because I really do feel like sometimes I ramble. There is... like, if someone is going to make a claim to me, like, there was a faith healer that healed somebody, what I expect is I want the resources. I want where I can look up this story. I want the scientific studies that show how this could be possible. And, I mean, even if science couldn't explain exactly how it happened, you would have to at least admit to me, or you would have to at least have enough evidence to admit that it did happen. Like, you would have to have, again, like, if someone really did faith heal someone's leg, you could have the x-rays at the beginning when their leg was broken, and then you could have the x-rays, like, 10 minutes later when it wasn't. And that would be evidence that their leg really was healed by this faith healer, but we never have that. It's so funny, by the way, that we never do, because, you know, I feel like that's part of the con in and of itself, you know, because if there was any truth to it, we would have found, like, people would have been eager to prove this thing right, you know? People would have been eager to be able to say, hey, you know, you're a faith healer, I want to give people definitive evidence that what you do is real. So I'm going to do something, right, like, where I take these x-rays and so forth. No one has ever done that. Ever. And so we have nothing to work with. So, if the supernatural were real, we would have people like Spock and Hermione and Gandalf, and people like that, who we could demonstrate, hey, this is something that happens. Like, even if science couldn't explain it, we would have to admit that there's a there, that there's something to discuss. But we never have that, you know? We don't see supernatural things happening on the streets. We don't see people, you know, flying on broomsticks, or, you know, I don't know, summoning dragons or things like that. Like, these are the kinds of things I would expect out of my everyday life if the supernatural were real, you know? Seriously. Like, if there were a talking snake, ever, we could go and, like, we could have snakes talking to us on the side of the road, you know? So that's, I've gone on long enough about that. I think it's time to get into the social aspect. So that's the supernatural. That's section one. Section two, I think I'm going to talk some things about my beliefs on society at large. And actually, I believe that these aspects are more important than the supernatural beliefs, because, you know, you can have supernatural beliefs and still be a good person and all that. I do think that the belief in the supernatural is sort of a manipulation tactic among people, among the higher-ups or whatever, but I don't think that the people who are religious or who believe in the supernatural or whatever, I don't think that those people are necessarily bad because of that. I do think they're wrong, but I don't think that there's anything necessarily wrong morally with being someone who believes that, you know? Now, a big aspect of my social philosophy is I would say I'm an ardent collectivist, and I'll explain to you what that means. I'm very much against individualism in society, to be honest with you. Hang on one second, I'll... Sorry, I had to take a little bit of a break. So, I'm a collectivist, which means I am going against what most Americans believe. Most Americans don't even want to admit that they're individualists. And hell, I might even be an individualist to some extent just because I was raised in individualism all my life. So there are probably individualistic things, tendencies I have just because I was so ingrained with individualism all my life. And, you know, we talk a lot now about, like, Marxism and leftism and things like that, but we talk very little about individualism and the effect that it has on us, really. And honestly, I think that the individualism that we see and have is most of what's ruining us. I mean, there's the economic things. Like, I am also a Marxist. I am a socialist, but I'm definitely not an individualist. I don't think that we should be maximizing for individual benefit or well-being. I really don't. And that's a very controversial thing to say. I understand that. But I do want to get into the justification that I have for that. You know? I honestly think it's kind of sad that that is controversial because, I mean, we do, I feel like we would agree that being nice is good, that, you know, things like, you know, helping other people is a good thing. But those, I feel like we just say those things. We don't actually hold them to be something that we, I don't know, that is a part of our actual identity. We don't take them seriously enough. You know, we more hold them as, like, ideals rather than living by them. You know what I mean? And I know it's hard to admit that to yourself. Whenever I ask somebody who I know is an individualist, whenever I accuse them of being that, they fervently deny it to me. And I get it. Like, it's, I mean, but then they go on to say the things that an individualist would say after that. You know what I mean? Like, I think my favorite expression that I think signifies individualism is, well, but at the end of the day, that's the phrase I often hear when an individualist comment is followed by that. So you might think it's funny that I identify as a collectivist and am against religion and spirituality because a lot of collectivists are spiritual. And I get it, you know? That is a good aspect of religion that I think is good. I think that we should have a collective identity. I think that we should sincerely care about our communities, you know? I think that spirituality has been a convenient excuse for that, and I think that's good. I just think that we should also recognize facts as facts and not make things up, because there are other harmful effects of religion. It's not all good, but I think that a lot of religious people, at least, do hold collectivist values, and I do agree with that. So, does anybody remember the hippie movement from the 1960s and 70s? Now, I'm not going to claim that they were, like, perfect collectivists or whatever, but we can't deny that they applied a lot of collectivism to their philosophy, you know? And that was, like, I think the hippie movement was probably the origin of a lot of what the left in America is today. So we should be giving them a lot of credit for essentially giving us, or at least, at the very least, advancing these concepts that we have right now about, like, you know, being against oppression of minorities and things like that. And so, you know, I forgot where I was going with that, to be honest. But yeah, they had good ideas, but I feel like we've gone astray from that, even on the left. And I do want to say, before I start getting into this, that I do not believe that the left is wrong about the things they assert. I do believe that that we should be fervently against racism. I do believe that we should be against capitalism and things like that. That we should, you know, we should be against all forms of bigotry. That's something I guess I should get out of the way now. I think that, you know, women's rights matter. I think that Black Lives Matter. I think that LGBT rights matter. I think that, you know, we don't give a whole lot of focus, even on the left, about people with disabilities, which I think is, you know, is something we should put more focus in. You know, and we should be striving for, you know, workers' rights and you know, people in general should not be marginalized as much as they are for just being poor. You know? So I'm very much for equality. There are intersectional ways in which everybody is affected by the patriarchy and our white supremacist society and such like that. We need to get rid of those structures, and we need to consider people as equal. I will say that a lot of conservative people will tell me, oh, well, or a lot of more conservative people will act as if, you know, these problems have just gone away. That, you know, like, men and women are equal now. What are you talking about? You know, or, like, you know, black people have already got rights, so what more do you want? So, people who make that argument, I think it comes from a position of privilege. Well, that probably shouldn't be the way I word that, because that sounds really bad to those people. But it's not just privilege. I'm going to go into something else, because I mean that argument's been drilled down a million times already. If you want to just look at gender, okay, we have such rigid ideas of where people of certain genders belong, even still. Now, it has gotten better. It hasn't gotten that much better, though, let's be honest. You know? Because in a truly equal society, like, you would see men and women being able to just be friends as, like, just equals. As just the same as they'd be able to be friends with a guy, they could be friends with a girl, too. But that's, in fact, not what we see. Most of the time. I mean, I know there are exceptions to this, but generally, if you go and look around you, who is a girl hanging out with? She's probably either hanging out with her partner, or she's hanging out with some other girls. And on the contrary, you have guys, and most of the time, they hang out with other dudes, or their partner, who is usually female. So, even just that alone tells you there is such a rigid divide between the genders that we have. And I don't think that's good. A lot of people will tell me, like, hey, you know, but, you know, men and women can't be friends. There's always going to be some, you know, amount of romantic or sexual tension there. It's not, like, that's why we can't be friends. But, like, you know, when people make claims like that, they're taking out of account, like, what about asexual and aromantic people? What about gay people? You know, like, you know, stuff like that. So, well, that's the first thing. But even for people who don't put them into the same category, the other problem with that is, you know, that there really isn't a fundamental difference, psychologically or biologically or whatever, between men and women. To the point where we can actually commit surgeries that are not that damaging, to be honest, to change someone's to change someone's sex hormones. So like transgender people will go, you know, through this procedure, and it's similar enough that can actually work, you know. So there's really not that much of a fundamental difference. But the way that we are raised as a man or as a woman is very, very rigidly a certain way, you know, even still. And this is evidence that we are not equal. We just aren't. We are very far away from being equal. If we were equal, we wouldn't care about any of that. You know, we wouldn't care about, oh, well, being a girl means this or being a guy means this. None of that would ever matter. We would just treat people as people, and it would be completely unbiased and you know what I mean? Honestly, if you want me to be honest with you, I think in this manner, we probably are further away from gender egalitarianism than we are from racial or, like, racial egalitarianism or LGBT rights. We're closer in those areas than we are to gender egalitarianism, honestly. Because, you know, the way I see it, it's so different, you know? And I mean, there's been debates online that have come up about, like, oh, well, you know, actually, look how lonely men are. Even on the left, like, this is a huge thing on Twitter or whatever, and I try to stay away from Twitter, but I happen to know that this was happening. Like, people were saying, like, you know, oh, like look how much lonelier men are getting than they used to be. And, again, that's a problem with the patriarchy, and that is a very real thing, by the way. It's not a... it's a very real thing, and it very, in a very real sense, is a product of the very thing that I'm talking about. It's not because feminism has gone too far, because it hasn't. That's not the problem. If you want me to be honest with you, I think it's because individualism has gone too far. If you want me to be real with you, like, I think in all aspects of society, including the left in America, and including, like, when we're talking about misogyny or feminism, either one, both cling to individualism very strongly. Generally, I mean, there are exceptions to this, but generally, and I would agree, again, I would agree with these movements. I really would. I just disagree with any amount of individualism that's applied to it, you know? So now I start to bring up individualism again. So I'm gonna start going into what I think individualism is, and I'm gonna start defining terms and stuff. So individualism is the focus on self over other people, in my understanding. So your car is your car. Sharing your car is kind of like blasphemy in many parts of American society, honestly. And that is, honestly, that's incredibly, that might sound silly, I know. And a lot of people would tell me I'm being silly for making such an assertion. But really, you only think it's silly because I'm challenging your idea of what's normal. It's just normal not to share your car with your neighbors. It's just normal not to do that. And if they ask for it, that's weird. But you know, it's actually normal. In collectivist countries like Malaysia or the Philippines, it's very normal for people to share vehicles. In fact, it's normal for people to just walk into each other's houses without, you know, much reason to worry about that, you know? So these boundaries are very rigid when it comes to individual identity, in America specifically, because America has a very specific kind of individualistic culture where it's like, you know, and this is nothing new. This is absolutely nothing new. We can go back historically and we can see, like, you know, the Western novel, and after that the Western film was such a popular genre in American media that, you know, and I think that alone shaped a lot of our views on what a man should be, especially what a man should be, but also just what people should be. People should only worry about themselves, or at least they should worry about themselves long before they worry about anybody else. So a lot of people who are listening to this would think, well, but why is that wrong? You should worry about yourself. And I would agree, especially in this society, practically, you should worry about yourself over other people. Practically, you should, in this society we live in, because no one's going to help you in this society we live in. You can only help yourself. But I'm saying, idealistically, we should not have to rely on just ourselves. We are a social animal. A social animal. So it makes, it actually, if you even just account that little tiny factor into it, it makes very little sense. Very, very little sense that we would even cling to something like individualism, because it seems kind of contradictory to human nature. And it's funny that I say that, because it absolutely is contradictory to human nature. And the evidence that you can see for how harmful that is, guess what? America is one of the most mentally unstable countries in the world right now, and has been for some time, quite some time, evidentially. And it probably has been for a very long time. Like, it probably has been even longer than we have research available on it, because of this individualistic mindset that people have. People for centuries, like, especially, I mean, starting in the 1920s and onward, you had writers like, his name is escaping my memory. The writer of The Great Gatsby, for example. I think his name was F. Scott Fitzgerald, if I'm remembering correctly. That sounds right. But yeah, there were writers like him. People of the Lost Generation wrote about alienation, very specifically. You know, and it just goes on from there. Like, the origins of rock music. Like the origins of socialist ideology itself, you know, rock music, for generations, rock music has often been a testament to that very alienation that people often feel, that ruins people in America. This idea, oh, well, we should only worry about ourselves and not other people. So you're destroying the part of your social brain that is required to function properly. And if you want my personal opinion, that is a huge reason why so many marriages in America fail. Why so many marriages in America, it's not even just because divorce is a thing now that a lot of people do that they didn't do in the past. That's not the only reason. Marriages have never, it seems like they've never been okay in America. We have had huge problems with that throughout all of our history. And again, there's evidence of this. You can go back and look at old books and they talk about how toxic marriages were back then too. Go and read Edith Wharton, for example. Now, Edith Wharton was an individualist, a fervent individualist, and I would disagree very strongly with those aspects of her. But she does talk about this very way in which marriages have been toxic. But I think a lot of it has to do with individualism. Now, in collectivism, what we would have instead is we would have a focus on other people. We would have a focus on, not even just specifically other people, yourself too, but also other people in an equal manner. You would care as much about yourself as you do other people in your circle or your community or your family or things like that. You know? So I would go as far as to say that the focus that we have in American society on individual identity and discovering yourself is part of our downfall in and of itself. So ideally, we should have a collective culture, a collective identity. You should feel like your contribution to your society is not your property, you know? Idealistically, at least. You should not feel like your contribution is something that only you could have done. So, in my philosophy, I actually want to do away with I don't want to completely do away with individual identity. I think that there is some value in it, but I think we put way too much stress on individual identity in our society. I will say that the stress on, like, what are your hobbies? What are your strengths? What are your this? What are your that? What are your needs? What are your personal wants? What are your personal desires? We should also focus on other people's like needs, and we should kind of, I'm trying to think of a good way to explain this, but we should consider the needs of our community as our own needs, you know? So, I guess I can give you an example in the open source community, because I do a lot of work in the open source community. This is a software thing, by the way. Basically, the concept of open source is sort of like we waive copyrights from the things that we make, from the code that we write, from the data that we use, from the system that we're making. We waive copyrights from it, and even further than that, we want other people in the open source community to edit our work. We want other people to, you know, modify it and to share their ideas, and it's sort of a system where everybody's ideas are valuable. You know what I mean? So in the open source community, I write a piece of code and five other people go and modify that and make it better, you know? And we don't necessarily have a focus on the individual who wrote the code. We have this is a very important element. We don't want to focus on the individual who wrote it or the individuals behind it. We want to focus on the product itself. So for example, there is a downloader that is open source called YouTube DL. And I actually really like this because it's basically a YouTube downloading tool. It is open source. And to be honest with you, I don't even know the people. I can't even name the people who were behind it off the top of my head. But that doesn't matter, because what mattered was the product, not the people. You know? And in the same sense, I want to think that my contributions to humanity are contributions to humanity itself. But I think the way that we often want to think about it is that it's not contributions to humanity, it's contributions to ourselves, you know, that this is who I am. Now, I do a lot of work with coding. I do a lot of work with transcription of old books and things like that. I want to think that the things that I'm doing are benefiting anybody, not just myself, you know. Now, they will benefit myself, inevitably, but at least I hope, and I also know, that anybody can come along and use my work for whatever they want. And, you know, I can't deny that that in and of itself gives me some satisfaction. And they don't have to credit me. They really don't. They don't have to credit me for my work. I am one of the rare people who makes it an express, I'm trying to think of the word here. I expressly waive all of my contributions that I can into the U.S. public domain, which means I don't want to copyright anything that I ever make, because I believe in this concept of collectivism. I believe that people should be able to use my work for what it is, not because of me. You know? Does that make sense? So, my work is a tool to be used for some purpose that is useful, educational, whatever, you know? Or even if it's just entertaining. Even entertainment itself is a utility, honestly. And it can be used as a utility for something different than it was even intended. Like, for example, you can take a fiction novel and you can use it for language processing, which wasn't the intention of the fiction novel, but it is another use you can use for it. You know what I mean? And that would be a valid use for it. And that's another reason why I'm against copyright, but I don't think that I'm going to be able to get into that in this little tirade that I'm going on. So, yeah, when it comes to my work, okay, I'm trying to think of the way to word this. I'm really bad at this. I feel like this is I haven't even been doing a very good job at explaining my philosophy. But I hope you get the idea that I release the copyright on all my work specifically because I don't want to limit people's use of my work. Not just that though, but I don't want to attach an identity to my work. I just want it to be useful to people. You know? That's all. That's it. That's it. You know? I just want it to be useful. And again, I think personally that's how everyone should view work and, you know, the things that they are and the things that they do should serve the collective, not themselves. Ideally it should serve the collective first and the self second, at the very least. And by the way, for those of you who are concerned about the self, I think that this would actually benefit. This would actually benefit the self of people in society as well. So, I've gone on too long. I have work that I have to do. And thank you to whoever listened to this fully. I actually, to be honest with you, I made this for a friend who asked me to make a little thing about my philosophy. And so here it is for that friend. You know who you are. But for anybody else who wants to use this, I am releasing this into the public domain as well. So feel free to use this audio clip for whatever the fuck you want. If you want to use it for language processing or AI or like whatever, I'm totally cool with that. You don't even have to credit me. You can just go ahead and use it. I'm actually probably going to upload it to Wikimedia Commons instead of YouTube. Because I don't know. It just doesn't feel appropriate for YouTube. And also, I feel like I want to make this publicly available and usable for whatever purpose you might deem it useful for. So yeah. Again, it's part of my collective contribution to humanity. You could put it that way. And all of my work that I ever do, I want to see it as such. So anyway, with that being said, I appreciate your time in listening to this, and I hope you have a wonderful day. Maybe even if you agree or disagree with some of the points I've made, at the very least, I hope that you appreciated I'm trying to think of the word for it. See, the cat always gets my tongue. I hope that you at least appreciated entertaining those ideas. So anyway, see you later.